Patron questions. Right, here we go. What is, in your opinion, the best adaptation of a book into a movie, and what is the worst? This is a very interesting question because, I mean, look, I'll get this out the way. It's an obvious one. I think the Lord of the Rings books are masterful. I think the way they were brought to the screen, I remember thinking at the time, because obviously I was very much interested in that. I remember thinking at the time, there's no way they'll be able to do it. There's no way they'll be able to bring that world to life. There's no way they'll be able to get all of the story in. They'll probably have to cut all the characters out. Then there was the whole casting, which was like, who's going to be the fucking, you know, play the parts? And when I was adamant Sean Connery had to be Gandalf for some reason. I don't even know why. I don't even think that would have been good casting, actually, now. But then I was absolutely adamant. Sean Connery, it's got to be Sean Connery. And Sean Connery got ruled out, and they cast Ian McKellen. And I remember thinking, he's not got the fucking gravitas to be Gandalf. You know, and time obviously makes fools of us all, because now it's impossible to imagine anyone but him having played that role. Actually, just one second. I'm just gonna quickly bring this up. So I just want to show you something off the shelf in the background. I was a huge Lord of the Rings fan as a kid, and so it is dropping a bit. This is my Lord of the Rings dog-eared, but this was the copy I had as a kid. I fucking read this like cover to cover a million times. It's got these incredible illustrations in, if you can see, just really fucking beautiful artwork from, I think it's Alan Lee is the guy, and you can see there. So I mean, like, actually, I remember it's got a fucking great one. It's got all the appendices and everything in here that you would see. There's fucking Shelob and Shelob, depending on how you fucking choose to pronounce it. Just having a lurk there. So, anyway, I loved Lord of the Rings, and I was a big Lord of the Rings fan. And when that was... I loved the animated movie, which I've talked about in another one of these. I loved the animated movie. I thought it was a great travesty that Ralph Bakshi never got to make the second part. And me and my mates, we used to watch that quite religiously, you know. And I think one thing I'll definitely say is I don't think that movie gets enough credit. It's a mess. It's incomplete. It was filled with inconsistent animation for a variety of reasons. It was fucked by studio interference. But when the Nazgul go to the Prancing Pony and they kill what they think are the hobbits, and then it turns out they put pillows in the bed and they're in another room. That scene, the choreography of that scene in the movies is almost shot for shot from the animated movie. And so it should get more credit, but it was a failed adaptation. What Peter Jackson did is just a masterpiece of cinematic production. All the effort that went into it is there on the screen. The only thing I disagree with, the only mistake I think he made, is maybe Aragorn was just a little bit too heroic. And certainly cutting Saruman's death out of the third movie for time constraints is a curious oversight, because you had him set up as one of the big bads in the first two movies, and then his storyline is completely cut out of it. And, it obviously created a bit of a feud for a few years with the great Christopher Lee and Peter Jackson, which they patched it up, and obviously he kind of wrote him into the Hobbit. So, yeah, his death was only in the extended edition. In the cinema, in the version that went out to the cinema, Saruman's death is not in the movie, if you can believe it. And that, to me, is the only mistake that I thought Peter Jackson made. It was just, your movie's already 2 hours and 45 minutes in the theatrical cut. So just fucking put that in. what do you mean time constraints? People... But it also, I will say, it's got a bit of a dubious cinematic legacy, because one of the things it did do was it kind of gave permission to directors to say, hey, just make your movies longer. Fans will sit in the cinema for 3 hours. We've proven it. They'll do it for Lord of the Rings. Here's the difference. Lord of the Rings, it was an experience. It was a cinematic experience. Those movies coming out, it was like the most hyped shit. Everybody went in the cinema. The cinema was fucking full. Generations of people that have loved the books were all, you know, and kids that just wanted to see a really good family action movie, essentially. They all went, people were queuing up. You couldn't get seats, you couldn't get tickets on release week. That is not the same as Django Unchained having two endings because Tarantino is getting indulgent in his later years. That's not the same as Oppenheimer, which was probably, if we're honest about it, good as it was, 20 minutes too long. And so I do think one of the bad things that came out of the Lord of the Rings adaptation was that, you know, it sort of gave permission for movies to be longer and longer and longer. And now the average, you know, whatever happened to a good 90-minute movie, right? You just go in, hour and a half, you watch it, you fuck off. No. And obviously, the other problem is it gave birth to the Hobbit trilogy, a trilogy that should have never been a trilogy, and films, honestly, that shouldn't exist. Just studio slop. I rewatched them a couple of years ago, and maybe 18 months. I wanted to see if I could have like a reappraisal of them. And no, they're garbage. They are utter garbage. They are edited terribly. They are paced terribly. The acting is terrible. What's he called? Martin Freeman or whatever from The Office is a cunt. I can't stand him. So that's a problem from the get-go. The final battle is anticlimactic. The elf-dwarf love interest is stupid. They are objectively bad films. They are actually objectively bad films that should never have happened. And I'm kind of, I hope, if you've ever seen the documentary Hodorowski's Dune, about how the Chilean director Hodorowski wanted to make Dune and he never got to make it, but he had all these insane ideas and they made a documentary about it. I hope we get an equivalent of that for what we would have had, because people seem to forget it wasn't Peter Jackson who was meant to do The Hobbit. It was meant to be Guillermo del Toro. And that, I think, one movie, Guillermo del Toro doing The Hobbit, or two movies, I think, as it was then later cut into. It was never meant to be a trilogy. That's why it feels like stretched. Guillermo del Toro's fucking Hobbit would have been baller as fuck. I know that for a fact. He would have aced that assignment. I think he doesn't get enough credit, actually, for the worlds he's built in movies. Like Blade 2, for me, is better than Blade. I think it's wonderfully fleshed out. Great monster special effects. I think The Strain is an underrated TV horror show. I think his adaptation of Hellboy was fantastic. And super underrated films. And obviously Pan's Labyrinth is a modern masterpiece. Like it's incredible. So him making fairy tales, adult dark fairy tales, that's all he's ever wanted to do. If you watch that TV series of his on Netflix, his Cabinet of Curiosities, there are some really good episodes in that as well. Just putting that out there. Right, but yeah, back to the question. Adaptation. What is the best adaptation and what is the worst? Worst? I mean, The Hobbit probably is a contender, honestly, but thinking about like some books that I loved that were just ripped to shreds, it's kind of one of those things where if you go away and think about it, yeah, this is controversial. I Am Legend fucking stinks. The Will Smith one, it stinks. I know that's going to upset a lot of people, but it's true, and it's knowing it. Richard Matheson was a fucking genius. And to see the book done that dirty is very upsetting. It misses the complete point of the novel. So just in case that is a controversial opinion, it really is trash compared to the source material. I think the Dune movies are massive letdowns. I think they miss out on all of the intrigue and interplay and instead give a very surface level reading of the world. I think they completely missed the point as well. Not to mention what they do to Charney's character is criminal. She's far more nuanced and understanding in the book. I mean, you know, again, they make her jealous. They make her a jealous girl at the end of the second film. But in the, she was from a culture where people, you know, she understood politically he had to marry the princess, and you know, Paul had to do that. That was it, so that was kind of terrible. Dark Tower is a very good shout. The Stand, Stephen King adaptations in general, that could be a subcategory of their own. But Dark Tower is one of those where you want it to do well. You want the source material to be adapted in a good way. It's very imaginative and interesting, and the characters are great, and it's a very interesting world. But ultimately, yeah, the adaptation is dog shit. I mean, like a 2 out of 10 movie, which is crazy. It's got Matthew McConaughey during his renaissance in it, and he kind of stinks in it as well. So yeah, I got a friend. You know him. I'll be plugging his book. If some of you bought his last one, Gareth Wood, G.J. Wood is his author's name. He is a, he's back in print. His new book's coming out. It's actually being promoted by Ramsey Campbell, which is a name that will mean something to some of you. And looks like it's going to be, a big seller for him. He's got a controversial opinion, which we've argued about for the 20 plus years we've known each other. And that is that he thinks The Shining movie stinks, and he thinks it's a terrible adaptation, and he thinks the book is better. I have the complete opposite opinion. I think the movie elevates the source material. He hates Kubrick. I think he's a genius. So, I mean, Gareth has a lot of hipster takes. He does. He is a contrarian. You can imagine what it's like when me and him are arguing. We're just too immutable fucking contrarians that we just will not move. But yeah, that's what he thinks. It's not the wildest take, maybe. I can understand that people might think the movie is overwrought, I guess would be a fair description. Here it is. I'm looking at my bookshelf. I've nailed it. The worst adaptation. Get ready. From Hell. Boom. There it is. 100%. That's my answer, and I'm sticking to it. From Hell, the comic, is just a masterpiece. Alan Moore tells essentially a history of the creation of London and Freemasonry, and he does it, through historical retelling of the Jack the Ripper murders. It's brilliant, and it's one of the greatest comic books. And again, I shouldn't call it that. Alan Moore would fucking he'd punch me my lights out for doing that, or cast a spell on me, you know, whichever way he decided to go that day. But Alan Moore's graphic novel is exemplary work. The adaptation is, I think, Johnny Depp playing a sort of proto Captain Sparrow. And what's the name of the chick in the movie? I can't remember it, but anyway, it just horrendous, horrendously bad adaptation. Bears no resemblance. Heather Graham. Yeah, that's it. Heather Graham. Terrible. Like, Heather Graham. Fucking hell. Doesn't play the role of a Londoner very well, let's put it that way. It's not Keanu Reeves in Dracula levels of bad, but it might be, or Tom Cruise in Far and Away, but it's up there. It's what a top five dog shit. So yeah, that's it. Best adaptation, moving away from Lord of the Rings, because I don't want that to be my answer, because it's a bit generic. I would probably say One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It takes a book that some people bounce off because it is told from a perspective of somebody watching Jack Nicholson, watching McMurphy, and it makes him the protagonist. And in doing so, I think the book is excellent. The movie is excellent too, despite being told from a different perspective. The performances in that are across the board just unbelievable, and Jack Nicholson, I think it's one of his standouts. I mean, you know, he's got a lot of them, but you'll find it very hard to find a Jack Nicholson performance that's better than that. I certainly don't think his later work is actually all that good. I think he kind of went the same way as Robert. Not a popular opinion, this, but I think he kind of went the same way as Robert De Niro. That basically, when Jack Nicholson was good, he was the best, you know, he was up there with the greatest actors of all time, but then he sort of became a parody of himself, and you know, his later work's not very good, is it? I mean, let's just be real. And he, being his fucking role in The Departed is so over the top and so scenery chewing, and I think that movie is so overrated. To give Scorsese, an actor, an Oscar for that is just ridiculous. So yeah, we'll say that. Special mention to David Cronenberg's Naked Lunch. Naked Lunch is a book that's impossible to adapt. So what did David Cronenberg do? He adapted the process of writing the book into a pseudo-autobiographical telling of William Burroughs' life with Peter Weller in it. And it's actually, I've got the 4K Blu-ray. Yeah, I think it's a great film, actually. So there it is. Right, next question. This is Frisky. Now more of the world knows your understandable hatred of Dennis Leary. Does that mean we can expect you to finish an anime before you get through Rescue Me? Yeah, I mean, look, the reality is Dennis Leary is everything that's wrong with comedy, everything that's wrong with Hollywood and the entertainment business. He's absolute trash. I mean, look, there is a bit of a double standard in the world of comedy when it comes to stealing people's jokes. And so, for instance, Robin Williams, rest his lovable soul, he was a joke thief. He stole people's bits. Many comedians from around that time have anecdotes and stories about how Robin Williams took their material, performed it in his set while they watched, and then would just give them money and say, oh, sorry. And, you know, that's kind of the very, you know, it's a really gross way to handle it. And Joe Rogan, who's attacked joke thieves in public for stealing jokes and has been very vociferous with some. Let's Amy Schumer. You know, there's a 15-minute video on YouTube of all of the bits that she's stolen and put into her sets. But how it is with Dennis Leary, was a fucking really milquetoast, just shit observational comedian. And then essentially he was watching from afar as Bill Hicks started to get famous. And Bill Hicks, I know, for me, he'll always be the greatest stand-up. The problem you always have with stand-up is when comics die, people come afterwards and they're funny, and sometimes comedy gets anchored to the past. I don't think Bill Hicks has that problem, but some people do. When I see the top 100 comedian lists now, I see people ahead of Bill Hicks that have got no right being up there. And that's my opinion, and I've studied the history of comedy. I think I have very informed opinions about that. But anyway, Bill Hicks was the greatest for me. And yeah, I caught him as a kid and in my formative years, and he made a very big impression on me. But anyway, Dennis Leary basically saw Bill Hicks's bit. Bill Hicks was the don't give a fuck comic. Bill Hicks was the guy who got on stage, he'd be dressed all in black, he would sweat, he would smoke on stage, and he had all of these bits about, you know, look, I'm never going to quit smoking. You know, vices are there. They're a fucking, you know, we should legalize all drugs. Fuck you. Fuck your judgmental bullshit. Fuck all you Christians. You know, it was like that. And, you know, had some unbelievable edgy breakdowns on stage. The Freebird thing that's being referenced there in chat is fucking legendary. I always thought it was fine, but you can't even repeat what he says on stage now. Such are the times. But anyway, I always thought he was the best. Now, during that time, Dennis Leary suddenly transformed into a guy who would come on stage wearing a leather jacket. He would suddenly have this cigarette affectation, and all of his bits were about, yeah, so what if we're gonna get cancer, who cares, cancer, give me fucking 10 tracheotomies and all this stuff. And it's like, hang on a minute, these are just really shit versions of Bill Hicks's material. It wasn't so much he stole the jokes directly, he stole the sentiment, he stole the mood, but then didn't have the material to back it up. It was crazy to watch at the time. And he did a special called No Cure for Cancer, and terrible. I must have watched that special so many times in the 90s. I used to hate watch it. I was such a big Bill Hicks fan, and Bill Hicks was dead. Bill Hicks died of pancreatic cancer. You know, I'm Bill Hicks and I'm dead now. He really is dead now. And you know, listen, it's a terrible thing to say about anybody, but you took his style, you took his material, you couldn't copy the fucking disease, Dennis. Like, you couldn't go all in, you fucking piece of shit. So I hate Dennis Leary. I hate him with a passion. I can't stand his fucking face. I can't stand his face. I can't stand his voice. His material is ass. That he has been materially rewarded with. I mean, he came. He's in fucking Demolition Man, just doing his stage act. Like, why? He plays a guy who lives in a sewer and he's like, I want to eat fucking rat burgers and I want to do what? It's like, oh, fucking shoot me in the fucking head. This is terrible. You know, Bill Hicks would never have done, he would never have done a TV show. He would never have done a sitcom. He would never have done a movie. He would never have done those things. He was, at the time he died, for perspective, but at the time he died, after David Letterman pretty much finished him off in another unforgivable move. Before he died, he was in talks with Channel 4. Channel 4, for those of you who don't live in Britain, back then when we only had four channels, Channel 4 was considered the, you know, liberal, intellectual, artsy-fartsy TV station. That's where that sort of stuff got commissioned. And he was in talks with Channel 4 to create, like, this fucking show, which would have been not just comedy, but it would have been, he was going to bring on philosophers and, like, all the great minds of the time to talk around ideas. That's what he wanted to do. His comedy was going to be a way to get, you know, he would tell you a joke, but it was a way to make you think. Dennis Leary, none of that. He doesn't want you to think. He just wants you to belly laugh and ha ha ha, fuck the government, yeah. It's like ridiculous, you know? So no, I will never watch Rescue Me. And as I've said, I would never watch anime religiously for obvious reasons, but I have certainly watched some anime. And you know, back when anime wasn't teenage protagonist in apocalyptic setting but is still worried about dating a girl and whether or not she likes him, before every anime was that, you know, I watched shit like Ninja Scroll, I watched Akira, I watched fucking Ghost in the Shell, you know what I mean? Like, they're good. They're good movies. I used to watch Aeon Flux on MTV. That's just good stuff, you know? So it's not like I'm adjacent. Whereas Rescue Me is fucking irredeemable. You need to be rescued from watching it. Right, back to the questions. Alfredo, now that we're nearly finished with 2024 and crawling our way through the decade, how much has changed from the 5 years of esports pre-COVID and nearly 5 years post-COVID from a working in the industry perspective? I think one of the interesting things is that the 5 years that we sort of, during the COVID years, we made it acceptable to produce shit again. And that was like, probably a good thing. I hate the cynical lies that everybody told during the COVID era. You know, for instance, one of the lies is that we lost, you know, the league collapsed, or we had to cut budgets because we lost so much money during the pandemic. It's not true. They didn't lose money during the pandemic. We were a growth industry during the pandemics. People were indoors. We had more viewers. And during the pandemic, they all hired people. This is why during the esports winter largely is an overcorrection. It's a correction for over-hiring practices because people thought, shit, we're still growing. Like, we're recession-proof. We're pandemic proof. People use that to steal money. The esports orgs that took those PPP loans from the American government are a disgrace. They're a disgrace. The PPP relief program, by the way, I'm not just saying they were the only people that fucking took money from that. But if you don't know what I'm talking about, there was these pandemic loans that the US government gave out and they were designed so small businesses could make their payroll. That was the whole purpose of them. What ended up happening, a bunch of businesses that are like corporations and including these esports orgs, then because legally they could say, oh, well, we're financially struggling as well. They went and dipped into that money, took that money and then used it to pay, you know, their payrolls. And the Overwatch League orgs all did this. Activision Blizzard, by the way, helped sort of point them in the right direction. And I just think that's a fucking disgrace. I mean, that was like one of the most grotesque things. It was meant for like mom and pop stores. It wasn't meant for your fucking cool hipster. We've got 100 employees we don't need, but look, we all sit on beanbags in the office and play foosball in our lunch breaks. It wasn't meant for you. It wasn't meant for you. And all the people that lost their businesses during the pandemic that maybe didn't get enough, it would have been better in their pockets and not in the pockets of this money sink that is esports. But anyway, we cut budgets because we could. We knew people would accept it and we continued to grow. And then we've only just got back now to production value as a concept. I mean, think about what ESL Pro League looked like. I'll just use them as an example because I'm blacklisted by ESL, so anything I say doesn't matter. You know, think about what that product looked like during the pandemic and after the pandemic stopped, because realistically, by 2021, it just was something you were going to have to live with. You know, I still get a little bit kind of like, you know, blown away by people like, some people's brains haven't updated to where we're at. Which is, we're on like the fucking 10th wave of this shit. It's just another thing that's out there now. It's just going to get you. It's either going to get you or it isn't. You know, and I think, I've said it many times, I don't care if people judge me for it. People got really fucking stupid during the pandemic. A lot of people got really fucking dumb, and they said dumb things, and they did dumb things, and they burnt bridges for dumb reasons. All because, you know, they were trying to fucking outrun a fucking virus that we were always getting more and more information about. It people just went psycho with that shit because the media went full court press, and I hate to say it, but it remains true. The pandemic, were the media fear-mongering during the pandemic, was, it wouldn't have happened to the same degree if we didn't have in the US Trump and in the UK the Tories, Boris Johnson. It was essential that whatever happened during the pandemic was pinned on them. And so the media had to make it. It's like saying, you know, the fucking death counter. Why isn't it there now? We're still getting vaccinated. We're still wearing masks in public. So why are we not? Why is the death counter not there? And obviously, when it became politically inconvenient to count the deaths and put the deaths on, you know, Republicans or conservatives or, you know, whoever it was, suddenly it was just one of those things, and we wanted an amnesty on it. Oh yeah, mistakes were made. You know, I wasn't like look, I got the vaccine. I got as sick from the vaccine as I did from the Delta that I caught after the vaccine. Right, the vaccine didn't do anything for me. I mean, well, unless I ascribe to it me still being alive. which I'm not too sure. I came pretty fucking close with the Delta wave. My heart rate was 140 constantly for about fucking 12 hours. It was like I was running a fucking marathon in bed. My blood pressure was through the roof. I had a fucking fever that was like, you're supposed to go to the hospital with the temperature I had. And I had a fan blowing in my face and a fucking bag of frozen peas on my head, and I was still sweating cobs. And I nearly checked into the hospital, but fortunately, it broke, you know, on like the first 24 hours. So, but anyway, I had the vaccine, not by any stretch of the imagination, anti-vax. I think the vaccines were a bit shit, really. Don't think they did too much. Whatever. I mean, you know, good job on getting something out, I suppose. But also, I think they probably saved some elderly people, maybe. I don't know. I mean, look, I'm not a fucking virologist, am I? But ultimately, I think the reaction to, you know, you have to get it, I'm never going to sign off on that. I'm a fucking libertarian. Like, I don't think the government should be able to compel you to do anything, frankly. But, you know, that's not when we start talking about bodily functions. But yeah, so I didn't like that, and I didn't like, you know, and I wore the masks, and I knew the masks were shit as well. These aren't medically fitted N95 masks. The people were wearing crochet masks people on planes were being made to take off N95 masks and put on paper masks. I remember that on a plane. Guy had a full proper medical mask fitted to his face, so tight you could see the fucking they were gonna deplane him if he didn't take that off and put on a paper mask. Yeah, it got deeply stupid. What about over here in the UK? You could go to a restaurant, but you had to wear a mask as you went in and queued up, but then you could take your mask off to eat in the restaurant. Over here as well, we had Eat Out to Help Out was a Tory scheme where Boris Johnson said because takeaways and restaurants were losing money, you should order takeaways. So great, I can order unhealthy food where I have to have an interaction with another human being that's a total stranger to me. And that person, by the way, if they're sick, they're interacting with dozens of people potentially in a day. That seems like a bit of a super spreader idea. So there was that. There was what we did at Christmas. This was our version of respect the science over here. Boris Johnson said no more than 3 separate family bloodlines were allowed to mingle during Christmas. How does that... How have we got there? Like, you could only have members of 3 different families and, like, no more than 14 or something. And this was at the same time we were all on an app. Like, they told me, a British citizen, when I came back to Britain after living in America for, you know, 5-6 years or whatever it was, came back to Britain and they told me they wouldn't let me into the country. I'm pretty sure that's just a violation of my rights. But they wouldn't let me into the country unless I was on a fucking tracking app. And I couldn't leave my house for 2 weeks. And I had to be there. And if they checked on me and I wasn't at home, I could get 10 years in prison. If I gave them a fake address, 10 years in prison. Like, what is that? Guys, that's mental. That's like, just, you know. Like, I just think we just went, just a little bit crazy on that one. So anyway, the pandemic was just a dumb time where everybody, like, lost their mind. And so in esports, obviously everybody lost their mind. And we started doing this thing where it was like, I mean, the League of Legends stuff was mental, if people don't know about that. They were running these, like, bubbles, but it was really weird. Like, there's stories that players have told me about, like, Riot had their own, like, tracking app that they had to sign up to and shit, and it was like, what the fuck? Like, yeah, I'm gonna give Riot the ability to fucking trace where I am at any given moment. There was like all mad shit going on there. And so, yeah, look, all of this long ramble that's nothing to do with the question is really just to say that, yeah, esports got dumb too, and what we did that was especially dumb is we were saying, oh, bloody hell, look, the pandemic's ruining us, please take pay cuts, please, oh, God, look, our production shit, but it has to be, look, we're pivoting back to online, we can't do anything in person anymore, and all the while still hiring people, all the while still picking up new teams, all the while still going into new leagues and new ventures. And then when the pandemic, long behind us now, you know, it's 2024, current year, it started in 2019, we are only just putting the production value back on screen. We're only just getting the levels and balance of employment right. It's like the esports winter is, it's true, esports doesn't make money. And it's true, esports is a shit broken industry because no one wants to pay for anything, but everyone wants more and more from this thing that makes no money. All of that's true, but equally, the reality about the winter is we're reacting to what we did during the pandemic. So all of the esports winter is pretty much the pandemic correction. We're getting rid of everybody. And we're right to do it. So I definitely think that's the biggest. Like, shows actually look good now. Next up, Jester. Always good to hear from Jester. Do you have a favourite punk band? Yeah, I do. It's the Misfits. You must have seen me wearing the Misfits t-shirts. It'll always be the Misfits. And of course, the problem you've got with the Misfits, when you're a Misfits fan, is obviously there are distinct eras of the Misfits, and some of them are worse than others. Static Age is like one of my favorite albums. And look, the history of the Misfits, where Danzig separated from the band, it's like Danzig wanted them to practice and get better musically, and the members of the band said, nah, we like the way we sound now. And so I kind of understand where Danzig was coming from on that one. That's his story. The band obviously dispute it, and they say it's you know, he's a cunt. But what they had, like, was just so unique. The idea, oh God, there it is. There's the first idea of the stream. The idea that at the time you could blend, like, horror, 50s horror and punk was very unique. And they created a sound which was like nothing else at the time. So very, very, very strong. And I didn't like Danzig's solo career, controversially. I remember when Mother was fucking played everywhere on MTV and he won a bunch of awards for it. And I just remember thinking, this is fucking whack. This is whack. This is like this isn't like anything on Static Age. It just fucking sucks. So yeah, not really a fan of it, honestly. So yeah, it's the Misfits, unquestionably, for me. I do like a lot of punk bands. I used to be in a punk band. I thought I was going to be a singer permanently. That was the plan. Never wanted to do any of this stuff. But then, I don't know, life kicks the shit out of you and you give up on your dreams and you settle for things. But I mean, I used to, so I was in a punk band, and we used to cover the Misfits. You know, we would just throw in randomly, like, Misfits songs, you know, Return of the Fly or whatever. And yeah, it was like, I just fucking adored that sound. And Static Age is just it's just banger after banger after banger. That's an album. You know, you get albums and there's like a track and you're, oh, fucking hate track six, it's trash, and you skip it, and then you go, oh, there's that skit, and you skip it, and then you go, oh, actually, I've ended up skipping two or three tracks here. The first half of the album's really strong, the second half of the album kind of sucks until the last track. And Static Age is, you just put it on and you just don't touch the fucking, you just don't touch the CD player as it was back then. You don't have to touch it. You just put it, you press play and you just walk away, and it's just, everything's a banger, just from beginning to end. And there's not many albums like that. There are some that definitely exist. I got some, you know, there's some hip hop albums I feel that way about, like Illmatic, and, you know, probably some metal albums I feel that way about. But yeah, the reality is that Static Age is probably one of the best punk albums ever recorded. It doesn't sound old. I mean, the sessions on that album, I think it was released early 80s, and the sessions on that album are from the 70s. And it doesn't sound like that at all. The sound is so crunchy and just fucking in your face. They sound like a 90s punk band on that record, and it's one of the best. Misfits, not even a question for me. Still listen to them all the time. This is a question from, it's either £2 or Two Wheels or something with a two in it. As the esports Stuart Lee, what's your opinion on him and his style of comedy? Obviously, I love Stuart Lee. Stuart Lee is one of my favorite comedians. I've definitely incorporated some of his syncopation into some of the bits that I do. It's definitely there. I think of when I'm telling a joke about esports, well, I'll set it up like Stuart Lee sometimes. The way Stuart Lee will do a joke, like, I mean, you can't really reduce his style to sort of one thing. But one of the things he will do is he will do a sort of precursor setup that you don't realize is the setup for a joke that comes later. And then he'll say, you know, and it'll say, like, you know, for instance, he'll do a bit on like how observational comedy is shit. And then he'll do a bit on how people talking about political correctness gone mad, and how comedy is kind of like, oh, they call it punching down now and all that. And he talks about that. And these are all just astute references to the history of comedy itself. But then he will do a joke, and the joke will be like, a black man, a Jewish person, and a Chinese person walk into a bar. What a lovely example of an integrated community. And so it's like that joke is funny in and of itself because it's a subversion of a type of humor, but it doesn't exist in the vacuum. It's specifically referencing the things he set up in the show, so it resonates a little bit more. Also, he's the only comedian I've ever heard talk about Brechtian alienation as a performance strategy, which is fucking crazy. The average stand-up doesn't know about that. So it's a thing called the distancing effect, and that was the alienation effect is the term Brecht used, and it's described thusly. It says, when you perform in such a way that the audience is hindered from identifying itself with the character in the play, acceptance or rejection of their actions and utterances are meant to take place on a conscious plane instead of, as hitherto, in the audience's subconscious. So he uses that in his performance, and it's definitely there. A typical trope of a Stuart Lee show is he starts adversarially with the audience. He'll tell a joke and he's waiting for which joke it is. It will be different in his sets. I've seen him live a number of times. But sometimes there'll be a joke that doesn't land, and this is when he'll start to segue into the adversarial nature of the attacking the audience. He'll say, oh, not a big laugh for that one. Well, I'm just saying the reason that joke is funny is this, and you are going to have to raise your game because, you know, people do come and they do enjoy me, and you're not intelligent enough to appreciate me. You know, he sets it up like that, but then he divides the room. And so if there's a bigger laugh from one section of an audience, he will then specifically reference that and kind of turn the audience against itself to create this very awkward environment and this nervous laughter. He's got a new special coming out soon. I saw him touring for that. I saw him in Malvern, which I think is where he lives. I think he lives in Malvern. Certainly when I was in Malvern, I saw him at a bookshop. There's a great secondhand bookshop in Malvern, run by a wonderful lady, and he was there, and I didn't say anything because it must be, I doubt very much he's that kind of guy that would appreciate some dickhead coming up to him and going, I really like your work. And I saw him doing this set in Malvern, and he does an exceptional bit about J.K. Rowling and her opinions on trans people. It is so smart. It's the best joke. I remember coming out of the theatre after I watched him, and I remember thinking about when I did the review of, like, Ricky Gervais and Dave Chappelle and their kind of jokes about trans people. And I remember what I said there, which is like, you know, there's probably some really funny stuff that can be, you know, written about the trans experience, but it's not going to come from Ricky Gervais, is it? And Stuart Lee might have wrote one of the funniest jokes about the trans debate that's been written thus far. And just to give you the basic premise of the bit, he talks about like how he would never get involved in anything to do with a culture war. He goes, listen, I've got kids that go to school. These people are nutcases online. Everyone gets really super offended and overzealous about that stuff. So I'm going to stay away from that. I'm not going to do anything about that, right? And then he proceeds to do something about that. He does a bit where he goes, you know, J.K. Rowling, beloved children's author, she obviously had some views on trans people and how you aren't the gender that you identify as. And not a little known fact is that J.K. Rowling wrote a number of books under a male pen name where she assumed a different gender identity for the purposes of fitting into society in a way that she felt comfortable with. And obviously I can't do it justice because I'm not Stuart Lee, but he just does that. He does this bit on using that information as a riff on who she talk about identity when she has you know, used, she has assumed a male identity for the purposes of selling books. And it's just so fucking smart. When he did it, because in case you don't know how comedy works, when you're doing a special, you have a bunch of material, you go on tour, you do the bits that you know you're going to use, and then you test out some new bits, and then you put together the strongest set for when you know it's going to be taped. And then that is the version that gets picked up on TV and put everywhere else. And anyway, I remember being in that room, and the fucking audience were so nervous, they didn't know whether they could laugh or not at that. And he must have loved it. He must have loved that reaction. And he was just there. He just let it sit for so long, excruciatingly painful, like just nervous. Like, I don't know if I can laugh at this anymore. And he's going, well, no, you see, because I wouldn't tell a joke about that. You see why? This is why. And it was just really good. And so his new special is going to be out soon if it isn't already. I strongly urge you to go look at it. And I think if you are somebody that has maybe been a little bit disappointed with, because I was, these last two that he did for the BBC, which was, what was it? Was it Blizzards? Was it Snowflake and Blizzard or something? Can't remember. But anyway, he did two back-to-back specials. He recycled some material in that, and they weren't very strong. But if you want to watch quintessential Stuart Lee, Carpet Remnant World is brilliant. If you'd like a milder comedian, Please Ask for One is also brilliant. They're probably his best two specials. For me, I'd put him, he's on the Mount Rushmore of British comedians, unquestionably. He's got his own style. Everybody, all the other comedians love him, but no one is intelligent or as well read as him to copy the style. So he's one of those. Everybody watches him, but nobody can copy him. And you know, he's on that Mount Rushmore of British comedians for me. He's up there with Billy Connolly. I'm going to be devastated when Billy Connolly dies. He's just recorded something on the BBC. It's like his memoir, and it's getting close because obviously he's got fucking Parkinson's now, and it's like, fuck, no, don't do it to me. Billy Connolly, growing up, huge fan of him, and you know, we are getting to the end there. But yeah, I mean, Stuart Lee is one of the greatest British comedians, and therefore by extension one of the greatest comedians of all time. Question: have you watched What We Do in the Shadows, and if so, what's your thoughts on the show? I'm sorry to do it to you, Tyler. It was recommended to me. All my mates love it. They love the movie. They love the series. They love Flight of the Conchords. I remember liking Flight of the Conchords at the time. And you know what? I tried watching it not that long ago. I thought, yeah, I remember laughing at that. And I haven't watched it since. I'll just rewatch it. I've totally forgotten it. I watched the first episode and I went, how the fuck did I ever find this funny? This is trash. And off it went. I guess I've grown to despise musical comedy and silly songs. And so I know it's the same guys and I know it's the same things, and I just can't handle it, actually. So I haven't watched it, and I don't think I will, even to answer your question. So sorry. Also, this is a controversial one. Matt Berry, who I understand is in it, I am kind of a bit sick of him. Loved him in Dark Place, one of my favourite comedies of recent years. Relatively recent years, I should say. It's probably about 20 years old, isn't it? But I loved him in that. You and him were buddies. It's brilliant. Hilarious. But now it's like he's just deep voice guy in everything he does. Cameo in Fallout was like, okay, that's kind of inspired, I guess. But just can't handle it. Can't handle it. Everyone's told me to watch that Toaster London he's in. Where it's like, well, it's like Stuart Lee, funnily enough, used to do a bit on, I think it was Fist of Fun, but it might have been the Richard Not Judy show that he did with, he obviously did comedy with Richard Herring, who has a great podcast. If you ever want to listen to him, Stuart Lee's been on it a number of times, I believe. But they used to do this bit where it was like, so they would take a phrase, which would be like, I don't know, let's get one. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree, right? And they would, and then this would be the sitcom. They would take the piss out of British sitcoms. And so Stuart Lee would be like doing a voiceover. New sitcom on BBC, The Apple Doesn't Fall Far From the Tree. Ian Apple and Ian Tree work in the Forestry Commission. Like, one is a spherical object, and it would go on like that, right? To show kind of how pathetic and uninspired TV programming was at the time. And I kind of feel like Toast of London, because doesn't he play a guy like Ian Toast and Ian London? It just looks like that garbage. It looks like the stuff that Stuart Lee used to parody on fucking Fist of Fun back in the day. So I can't do it. I just think Matt Berry's become this sort of like ubiquitous go-to guy who was never really that funny. And if the funniest thing about you is your voice, yeah, I'm kind of over it. Controversial, but yeah. Oh, Jerky. Favourite skateboarder? Is that a thing someone should have? Favourite skateboarder? I mean, I did used to watch all the Camp Kill Yourself stuff back in the day. Having the CKYs and all of the fucking spin-offs on VHS at university, that was the shit. We used to get fucking high and watch that non-stop. But I couldn't answer the question intelligently now. I remember I went through a skateboarding phase, because everybody does, or did, my generation, and me and my mate Tom at uni, we had one term at uni where we just had skateboards everywhere. It was like just fucking retarded. Like, what were we doing? I don't know. The chain and all of that stuff. And I remember I could talk about this. Like, I knew what I was talking about. I could tell you, like, the history of it and the difference between street and half pipe and all of this stuff. We used to get fucking blazed and play Tony Hawk's. Everyone did that. I mean, that was, 'cause I'm a Superman. But now, it's just not even a part of my fucking brain. Just don't have any strong thoughts or feelings about skateboarding at all, actually. It's just not a thing I really care about. So, sorry, but there it is. Another one. Oh, with the Shanghai Major around the corner, how much dick sucking will Valve do for this Major? I'm expecting keychains for weapons, the craziest stickers you can imagine, like those new lenticular stickers, maybe bring patches back, and maybe a few other things. Yeah, I am almost certain I saw my, you know, a big friend of the stream, Loba, who Maui Snake hosted Loba the other day when he was like doing a stream, and he raided him, and Loba immediately said, "Fuck off, Maui, I hate you all, I hate Richard Lewis." I'm like, fuck did I do? And so Maui's found out the hard way that the guy just is, he's just fucking gone, like there's just nothing there. Just ultimate brain rot, if he had much to rot in the first place. But anyway, he said that an operation is coming in September. Now, it's probably clickbait bullshit, and I can't believe he has any kind of insight or intel or connections with Valve to know those kind of things. I obviously do. I haven't heard anything, but then it's not the kind of thing I would be interested in or look into in the first place. And so it kind of feels like clout goblinry. But I will say, Valve would be fools not to put out some type of content, some type of purchasable content for the Major. It's a license to print money. They like money. I think Perfect World, who are their partners, will want content around the Major. It's all got to be Chinese approved. So I would back it. I would say, yeah, it's possible. You know, it's more likely than not. It's tough, because if Valve do nothing, people get pissed off. If Valve do something for this one, everyone's going to say it's dick-sucking and it's Chinese bias. This one is a little bit different. I've never had Major in China before. It'll be one of the biggest esports events, outside of, like, League of Legends Worlds. It's Perfect World specifically that are going to be running it there, with, like, PGL doing the English broadcast. And so I think ultimately There will be maybe not an operation, but I think the stickers will be fucking baller. I think there'll be a new feature added, not gameplay wise, but to content and cosmetic wise. And there will be something commemorative, I imagine, as well. Maybe an official release of a new map, something like that. So there'll definitely be something coming. There'll be a big content dump before the major. You can take that to the James Banks. Next up, Real Night Shift Hours asks, this is a Patreon question from Vash. Fuck, marry, kill, Anders Moses Thorin. I mean, I'm not going to answer that because it means I would have to kill somebody I'm friends with, and I'm not going to kill any of my friends. So, as an abstract, it's fine to ask it about like celebrities that I don't know because we tacitly know. Obviously, I'm not really going to fuck, marry, or kill any of them, and I'm not going to fuck, marry, or kill any of these guys. But I know them, and I don't want to have to think about them being dead. So. So yeah, just not gonna answer that. Jaden, Mr. Lewis, I hope you're having a wonderful day. What do you think happened to the disappearance of Malaysia Airlines MH370? Thanks. That's a fucking great question, isn't it? We do know it was just shut down, right? Like it was just shut down, wasn't it? MH370. Is that a different plane? Oh, so he's asking it, right, there's a conspiracy theory. I see. Okay, I know what he's trying to do now. Yeah, I'm thinking of the other one. I'm thinking of the plane that was shot down. Although, I don't know, a plane disappearing, let's see. I'm on Wikipedia, I'm trying to... I remember this one. This is the one where Don Lemon, as we're saying for some reason now, he had a guest on, didn't he? And he asked if... I remember watching it on CNN. I was in a hotel, I think it was doing an esports event at the time. And he asked if a black hole could have sucked it. Yeah. Could a black hole have come down and sucked the plane up? Yeah. And it's like... Jesus fucking Christ. The state of American news, you know? A black hole. Could a black hole have come and sucked up a plane and none of us noticed it? And it didn't impact on Earth's gravitational standing or anything like that. Genuine line of inquiry. I don't have an opinion about this. I'll construct one very quickly. Conspiracy focused internet sites claim that the official statement the plane crashed into the Indian Ocean is a blatant cover up. They note that a Boeing 777 does not have the structural integrity to survive crashing into the ocean, and that it would be comparable to hitting a concrete wall at terminal velocity. If Flight 370 hit the ocean, they say, it would have been broken into tens of thousands of pieces, many of which float on water such as seat cushions, and would be seen washing up on regional shores or easily spotted by search teams. Those criticisms diminished after several pieces of the aircraft were positively identified in the years after its disappearance. Harvard professor Cass Sunstein noted that the conflicting information initially released by the Malaysian government explains the interest in alternative theories. Sunstein, who has written on the topic, argued in an interview with the Wall Street Journal on the 20th of March 2014 that conspiracy theories in general often are born out of horrific and disastrous situations because such events make people angry, fearful, and looking for a target. Yeah, that's true. And then they blame the Jews, don't they? That's what happens in conspiracy theories. That's where all the roads lead back. If you go down the rabbit hole, it's almost as if there was a lot of anti-Semites on the internet, but that can't be true. And what would Cass Sunstein know about that? I don't know, man. I mean, planes just crash. It's a Boeing as well, by the way. I think we know now. Yeah. Them Boeings ain't what they used to be. So, I don't know. Probably just crashed. I mean, whenever planes crash, it's two things, isn't it? It's mechanical error or human error. And most of the time, it's human error. I believe that's correct. And so, the pilot fucked up, probably banked too hard. And that's that. But yeah, in retrospect, I'll commit to the idea. It was probably shut down by the lizard people for reasons. I just don't know. I don't know. I remember the coverage about it being deeply stupid. There was another news channel. Who was it? Yeah, this was it. The daughter of a famous American evangelist said it was raptured. Fucking raptured, guys. They said it was raptured. And it was the first of many, many such cases. So, but yeah, no opinions on that one, I'm afraid. Sorry. These last three questions haven't been as thoroughly answered. Jester with his second question. This is his previous one was last month. Which is more of a... Oh, it's more of a joke than a question. With you doing more events and esports taking a more fun trajectory in 2025 onwards, is there any chance we'll have a werewolf break at a PGL event? Listen, I would love nothing more than to be able to reference the werewolf break from The Beast Must Die in an official esports broadcast. But I'm probably not going to do that because self-indulgent segments, as fun as they were back when I was doing them with Duncan, they are kind of the antithesis of what should be in an event. I will say this, I'm going to get announced for an event very soon. And it's going to, in fact, I'm going to get announced for two events very soon. And it's going to, and both of them are going to upset people for different reasons. So I will be bringing a certain style to a game that's never had it before, and I will also be getting the band back together for the spiciest desk in esports soon. So everyone's going to hate it. Everyone's gonna hate it, so gonna be looking forward to it. So I'm just putting it out there. There will be no werewolf break at the PGL event. I mean, look, I don't know what I can and can't say, but I'll say this: in terms of events, I have fully committed to the PGL circuit, and they announced recently, you know, they're doing events in Astana and, you know, all over the world. There was one in Brazil. Which, I'll probably sit that out. Did say I can't go there and will not be coming to Brazil. So we'll see. But the rest of the events, put it this way, I'm not paranoid to a crazy degree. And I know I went into the Copenhagen Major thinking I was just going to get murdered. And I didn't get murdered, and no one even tried to murder me. And the worst thing that happened to me was probably someone tweeting at me, calling me a wanker with a photo from the crowd, which that was the worst of it. But I do think there's a pretty high chance I just get attacked in Brazil. I do think so. They believe, and it's not just like fans, but it's like their esports people, and Gaules is one of the biggest streamers in the world. They believe I'm racist against Brazilians. So that's a different thing. That's not, I don't like your opinion that you said about, you ruined Die by Power, you ruined Phantom Lord. They think I'm racist. And it's like I've always said, when you bring things like that to the table, people, you get a different level of upset. Yeah, they think I'm American. They think I'm an American gringo who hates Brazilians. And it's like, that's the narrative. So obviously, I think I'd probably get attacked. So I wouldn't go there, unfortunately. It's a shame. My friends, my real life buddies, because I do have them, I promise. They go to Brazil regularly. They've had an excellent time every time they go there. I mean, they've spent New Year's there in some cases. They love Sao Paulo, Rio. They love it all. They say, you've got to go. I can't. I wouldn't even risk getting recognized on the street at a non-esports event. So, yeah, that's a shame. But look, in terms of events in 2025, yeah, I am going to bring the fun back, mostly on the PGL desks because I can't work for any of the ethically compromised esports organizations. I said on a recent stream, if Blast ever wanted to give me a roll of the dice and they could find something for me to do and they can stop being babies about criticism, I wouldn't rule Blast out. I'm going to be working for two different esports orgs this year. And obviously there's going to be other options. I mean, I don't even know if Starlad is a viable option because people say I'm a Russian plant. They say I work for Putin on Twitter as well. So I don't know. But I'm available for work. I'll do kids parties at this point. Back to the questions. If you could resurrect any single LAN event, be it grassroots local from 20 years ago or something bigger like DreamHack or anything in between, what would it be and why? This is from Trogdoll. Good question. Good to see you. Don't always ask questions, mate. Trogdoll, what would I bring back? I mean, DreamHack's dead now. They announced that, didn't they? Just yesterday. I'll probably do that on stream tomorrow. But yeah, DreamHack's gone. In Yon Sherping. And while it was a terrible event to travel to and a terrible event to be at, especially if you weren't in the hotel right next to the venue, which fortunately I almost always was, because getting a taxi to and from the venue in the Bible Belt of fucking Sweden is fucking pure AIDS and costs you about €80 for a 15-minute cab. I always had a soft spot for that event. Hanging out at DreamHack with everyone in the VIP area was when I really, I think, fell in love with esports. That was, must have been about, shit, was when StarCraft II was the big ticket. It would have been 2010, maybe 2011, something like that. And because I knew Robert Olin, you know, he always used to roll out the red carpet for me. And I remember, I'm a nobody, you know. I mean, I'm not like a big influencer. I'm not a professional player. I'm just a journalist. But I got the VIP treatment. And as a result, I got to meet many, you know, great people that have made incredible contributions to our industry and form friendships with them. And I got an invite to the Good Studio. And that was a thing because of that. Like, you know, I know it's not the same. It's never been the same since they merged with ESL and ESL took over DreamHack and all that stuff. And well, it was never the same after they kicked Robert Olin out. But I know it's more like a place and time thing. That time in esports was stellar. We just like rebuilt after the collapse of CGS. All of the fucking, we'd had the global recession. Anyone who was left in esports in 2009 was hardcore. They loved it. They loved the space. And then 2010 come along and we started getting cool shit like YouTube and fucking Justin TV and Owned. And then new games, the new generation of esports games coming out. League of Legends, obviously, StarCraft 2. Call of Duty was popping off. CS was kind of in that weird pre-CSGO stage. It was the end of 1.6 and everyone kind of knew it. Rebuilding esports at that time was actually fun. It was fun. And it felt like we were going to be big and it felt like we were going to a good place. It really did. And watching everybody grift for fucking StarCraft 2 was a little bit nauseating. People who'd never watched a game of Brood War in their life suddenly saying, you know. And, you know, some bad things came out of it. It gave birth to the fucking esports diva. That era was insane for that. I couldn't believe it. But in general, everyone at that time there wasn't any esports tourists back then. When I used to sit in those rooms and talk to people, everybody knew everything. And everybody knew everyone. And everybody knew about everyone's projects and everyone's shit. And we all had the same, like, in-jokes. And we all had the same verbal shorthand. Because we were all doing the same thing. We were all part of the same, you know, community, I guess. And then 2015, 2016, that all starts to change. And unfortunately, we started getting this new grifter class and these dubious investors. Everybody was really trying hard to monopolize the space. Twitch had this weird, fucked up, disproportionate influence. And Riot Games had obviously taken over, and they were doing all this, like, fucked up shit. It wasn't the same world anymore. It was really, it was sad. It was sickening. I mean, obviously, 2015, I've talked about this before, so this, like, isn't, like, a big reveal or anything. I was I was thinking about like killing myself in 2015. I just, you know, there wasn't really any reason not to. As dark and as fucked up as that sounds, like I went through a horrendous breakup. My best friend had hung themselves while I was working an esports event, and had tried to call me, and you know, I went through like a really dark fucking time. And I just thought, I'll get to the end of 2015, I'll do these esports events, and then just like fucking, you know, write a note, record a video, hang myself, whatever. And, you know, had some pretty good friends pull me through that, and then obviously got the E-League job. And so I probably wouldn't have been in esports because, I mean, look, even if it was just dark, depressing thoughts about killing myself and I wasn't really going to do it, I was definitely going to quit esports. That was 100%. That had to happen. There was no reason to stay in. And then obviously, like, 2015, I get the E-League job, I meet Maria, lots of things start going right in my life, and it's weird. This is one of the things why I've always been of the perspective. I get a lot of messages from people, and it's like, I don't reply to them, because you shouldn't be asking me, because I'm not an expert on these things. If you're having a mental health crisis and you reach out, it's like, I want you to get well, but I'm equally not the person you should turn to for advice. I'm a fucking train wreck, right? And I've been in the exact same spot. But one of the things I always believe is, like, you have to hang in. You have to hang. Because you're a long time dead. You are a long time dead. And I get that sometimes life can be inescapably bad for some people. I think if you've got, like, if I ever had, like, locked-in syndrome, right? If I ever had like locked-in syndrome and, you know, something like that, I'd check out. I'd go to Dignitas. Give me the fucking green drink and I'd do it. I get that. But one of the realities about death is it's just eternal nothingness. And so nothing good. You're essentially writing off the odds that something good or positive can happen to you. And I hate that. I hate that platitude. It can only get better. No. That's not true. It can, not only does it not have to get better, it can get fucking worse. And that happens to lots of people that go through lives of quiet despair. But it certainly can't get better if you're dead. That's a fact. And I think that you know, that's always my sentiment. You just have to find a way to just fucking roll with the punches, man. Like, you just got to. Life will kick the shit out of you. It's designed to do that, by the way. It's an insane thing that we go through. We're the top of the food chain, but we're a mistake. We aren't supposed to be what we are. I've read lots about this. Metzinger, everything he says in the ego tunnel is complete, absolutely on point. Thomas Ligotti as well. Go read him. Consciousness is the fuck is the problem. Like, we're just, if we didn't have this sort of assured sense of a self and a purpose, and we were like the rest of the animal kingdom, we'd be having a great time. I'm pretty sure about it. Like, you know, it wouldn't matter that you're here and you're an organic creature and then you're not, and none of this would matter. But it's like we've created all of these constructs in our mind, driven by consciousness, to fucking believe these things that are fundamental lies, and it fucks us up. And so we make ourselves miserable a lot of the time because of our fucking shared delusion. And so, all of which, what a fucking mad tangent this is, but all of which is to say that I have a very grounded appreciation now of, you know, the finality of death, and the way that life is inherently ridiculous and absurd in and of itself. All of these, to be born, come online, develop a consciousness, and then have it dropped on you in your adolescence. P.S. You're gonna die. Like, remember when you're a kid, your parents tell you, what's death? You know, your fucking goldfish dies, or your grandma dies, or someone gets sick and they're going to die, and you get told about it. Whatever the childhood introduction to death is, you lose, you know, your pet, you know, dog has to get put down. And your parents tell you, yeah, everyone dies. And you go, and then they always add like a caveat. And they go, but not for a long time. Or, but that won't happen to you. And it slowly dawns on you, wait, it is going to happen to me. And then you grow up and you don't think about it too much in your teens. And well, you do because you go through an emo phase. And then you're in your 20s. And then you're in your 20s and you go, fucking got loads of time. And this is when you're supposed to find out what you want to do in life. And then you don't. You don't find a purpose and you beat yourself up about it. You get to 27, 28, you're going, shit, I'm still a fucking child. I'm still a boy. I think about what my parents were doing when they were 27. What my granddad did, he was in a fucking war. He saved Earth by now. And what do? I smoke weed and walk around with cum-stained fucking joggers on, scratching my nuts all day. I'm a loser. And then what you don't realise is that life is fucking different now, and you're not meant to have figured it out. Actually, it's impossible in this new complex society to have it figured out by 20. And you sort of get an idea at 29, 30. This is kind of it now. I'm finished. I'm evolved. This is as evolved as I'm going to get. Whatever I'm committing to now, I'm running out of time. The fucking runway is... I'm running out of runway. Like, this is it. Like, I've got to land the fucking plane now. This is it. So you land the plane, you land the metaphorical plane, and now you're in your 30s. And you go, actually, 30's not so bad. I don't feel any different. It's just like an extension of your 20s. And people live longer, actually, don't they now? So 30's fine. And then you get to like 34, and that's when it starts. And you go, oh, dear. Oh, dear. I can't get into them jeans anymore. I don't bounce back. I actually blow up when I have a meal now. I've got hemorrhoids now. I've got all these health problems and my back's fucking killing me. What's going on? Right? And so you realize, shit, mortality. Like now you're getting bodily changes and you're going bald and you're getting fat. You're not desirable anymore. Nobody fucking looks at you the same way. Not like you did in your 20s when you were fucking svelte. You had abs, right? And you could go out and party and get laid on a fucking weekend. Now you're a chud. And by the way, if you get to 35, 36 and you're not fucking married, being single at that age is sad, guys. I don't mind fucking saying it, right? It is sad. I went through a terrible fucking breakup that I thought was going to work out, and it didn't, and it gets sad. The dating in your 30s is sad. You get on the, you know, I'm talking, you can't be 35 on Tinder. It's sad. So maybe you go on a website and you think there must be other 35-year-olds out there. Well, let me tell you, if you're a man and you're straight, the pool of women at that age is they're all on the, they're rolling the last chance. They're rolling the dice. Biological clock ticking away. They're in a more sad position than you are. You just want to feel alive again. You just want to have a fucking bunk up. You just want to feel like you did in your 20s. You just want to feel the curious, giddy fucking rush of seducing someone and feeling sexually attractive one last fucking time. But you can't, by the way, because it's the last dance. It's 10 to 3. The nightclub's kicking out. And that's where you're at, societal-wise, right now. So eventually, you'll probably pair up with someone or settle down, or you won't. I don't know what's worse. And then 40 just comes out of nowhere like a mugger in an alley. Bosh. Hits you over the head. 40. Well, that's it. I remember when I was 20, I used to think 40-year-olds were old. I had relatives that died. I'm older than them. Right? I'm older than them. And so now you're looking back and you're looking at all of the pieces in your life and what you did and what you didn't do. And the 40s, that's just this is the start of the midlife crisis. This is about fucking regret. This phase of your life is about all of the mistakes hitting hard because you live in a reality constructed not from your successes, but from your failures. And you have to remember it every single fucking day. And you're reminded of it because these are the places you operate. Now, I ain't got too much perspective on 50s because I'm not 50, contrary to what Rocket League players say. But I've got some insight. I think I think the 50s are probably when you try and convert affluence and status into that one last roll of the dice. 60, mentally, we all know 60 is old. 50, man, George Clooney's in his 50s. Yeah, he's still sexy. He's still got it. That's probably when all the manifestations of the guilt and the regret and the horror and the misery of your 40s manifest into something, I guess, vaguely positive. Sad, because everyone's looking at you and they know it's fake and they know what you're doing. Right? But what I'm looking forward to is 60. I don't want to rush there, but the option is death. The alternative is being dead. It seems at about 65, you have this inherent... it's like you just hit a Zen state. You just hit Zen, and you realize, oh, I'll be dead soon. 7 years. It doesn't matter. I can say what I want. I can do what I want. There are no constraints. This was all an illusion. Maybe I did try a bit too hard. And suddenly you start to feel like the little moments matter a bit more. And the things that you prioritize and the things that you treasure, you do more of them. You do more of them. You're retired. Who gives a fuck? Becomes about something else. And then the horror of being infirm, 70, every day could be the last one now. Imagine you're living on your fucking tiptoes in the corner of your fucking eyeballs. And all you really want to do is just have someone there, I imagine. That was always the saddest thing. I had a girlfriend who used to look after the elderly. And they would, you know, she said when sometimes they would die and they would ask for relatives and they didn't get there. And they died with strangers. And that's it. And that's life. It's all a joke. It's all a joke. The best thing you can hope for is a family member being around to hold your hand while you die. And you know what? In that moment, before you take the fucking fractalized DMT trip into deconstructed consciousness, that is death, that'll feel really good. That'll feel better than anything. So there it is. Now, all of which is to say, if I could have any land, if I could have any land brought back, I would definitely go back to that time, because that was the time for me when I was in that 20s phase. And I was surrounded by people I admired and looked up to, and who conversely admired and looked up to me. And it felt like there was possibilities. It felt like I hadn't made the mistakes. It felt like I was going to go somewhere with it. And then I didn't in 2015. And then I did again at E-League. And then obviously terrible things happened to me after. So right then and there, being in that DreamHack VIP room with In Control and Too Good and Total Biscuit and Robert Olin and all the fucking, you know, commentators that I got to know down the years. It was great. You know, like, you know, meeting Anders for the first time, Semler. Everyone was having so much fun back then, you know. Like, everyone was so happy. I look at how depressed and, like, different and mean and bitter that, like esports itself was like a malignant poison that we were all passively absorbing through our fucking skin. It's changed a lot of people in the industry I like. And, you know, some of them I don't talk to. Some of them I still do, but it's like, I know that they're not the same person, that this industry has done things to them. And it's changed them. And it's, you know, it's sad. Back then, everyone had a smile on their face. I mean, for real. You know, it was always fun. So yeah, right then and there. It's that glorious moment of false belief in infinite possibilities before reality intrudes on your positive thoughts. Yeah. Okay, great segment. Love that question. Thank you. on to the next one. What are the five greatest things about being Welsh? Sense of humour. Sense of humour is paramount to Welsh culture. I think we have a wicked sense of humour, culturally speaking. I think Welsh banter, it is the harshest type of banter, but it is all done from a loving place. I love our appreciation of our own history. I love our dedication to the working class values. You will never get rid of that in Wales, by the way. The working class Tory was such an English thing. Was such a London thing. You know, such a, like, it happened in the Northeast too. I was around for it. But the working class Tory, you didn't get the working class Tories in Wales. Right? It didn't happen. Wales is like a time warp. That's another thing I love about it. Community. You do know your neighbours in Wales. I don't know my neighbour. You do know your neighbours. You know who they are, what they're about, for good or ill, whether you like them or you don't, you know who they are. You know, Wales is still like, it's like 70s, 80s Britain still. Now, you can knock on a door. Not everywhere. Some places are terrible and rough. But I mean, look, I lived in Sandfield, which is a notorious estate in Port Talbot. It's where Sam's from as well, I believe. And you get told all of this stuff externally. Like, you read about, like, how Sandfield is like, oh, it's this day, everyone's getting stabbed and burglaries and all of that. But then you open your door and you go, you all right, die? How's it going, bud? You all right? Yeah, all right. Down the fucking four wins tonight, though. And then you're off. Community, you know? It's like, it's weird. It's a place where you can still knock on a door and ask for a cup of sugar if you needed one, or a tea bag. Modern Britain doesn't feel like that as a rule. But in Wales, I think you still get that. It's why I always make the joke about Wales being like the Shire from Lord of the Rings. Been a very Lord of the Rings-centric episode of Patron Questions. But, I love that. I love that. When I go back there and I go to the working men's club and, you know, see old friends, it's like nothing has changed. Sometimes in a sad way, but sometimes in a happy way. So, yeah, sense of humour, working class values, a sense of community, songs. We love a song. You won't find many bars that don't offer karaoke as a form of entertainment in Wales. Simple as that. It's part of our culture. We love to sing. We love poems. We love riddles. We love all of that stuff. And for five, low-key, our mythology. I tell you, go out, get yourself an audio book of the Mabinogion and listen to it. Our flag is pretty baller as well. Having a dragon on there is fucking sick. But yeah, I mean, like, the national anthem is a fucking banger. I'd defy anyone. You know, like, it just puts fucking England to fucking... You know, whenever we have the fucking Six Nations and you're hearing the anthems, like, England's is the worst out of all the countries. Like, they've got to write a new one. It's fucking pathetic. Fealty to the monarchy. And then it's like, you listen to, like, Flower of Scotland, Land of My Fathers. It's like, it just doesn't fucking measure up, does it? So, the Welsh, man, got so much. The language, not a fan of it. The language, definitely not a fan. And all of North Wales can fuck off. So there you go. All of North Wales can fuck right off. South Wales, though. South Wales forever. No, I'm just kidding. The real... South Wales is the real Wales. Next up, from Colapora J. How long do you think before they exhume Thatcher so that Boris Johnson wears her face so he can go on to unify the Tory party so they can truly enact their cut VAT and kill the poor policy? This is a bit mental, isn't it? This is a schizo question, isn't it? We had to get one. We get one every episode. I don't know. I will just segue into saying I did see that version of Doom where you have to fight Mecha Thatcher got shut down, which is by Bethesda, which is really sad, as Trump might say. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, here's a point I'll make. I was going to bring this up. How are you liking your fucking definitely not the Tories in red ties? How are you liking Labour so far? Fuck me. I told you, not only would nothing change, I told you it would be a continuation of dog shit. I told you all. It was there. Yes, obviously the Tories had to go, but fucking this first, what's it been, like 6 weeks in charge? Just absolute terrible. I mean, Keir Starmer, right, has cut the fuel benefits for pensioners. Remember, this is our socialist party. Cut the fuel benefits for pensioners. And he keeps referencing this in, like, Prime Minister's Question Time. Keeps saying we're in a 22 billion black hole left by the Tories. And they're going to do this for all this coming year, 24, 25. all the blame's going to be on the Tories. The Tories did it. The Tories did it. We have to do this because of the Tories. At what point is it going to stop? We've had austerity measures now for like 15 fucking years. At what point do I get something back? Like, you told me to tighten my belt. I did. You then told me to tighten it again. I did. When the belt couldn't be tightened anymore, you told me I had to sell the belt for fucking medicine. And I did. You told me I was going to have to work longer. All right. You told me I was going to have to start putting more into the pensions and national insurance. All right. Suppose it's all in a good cut. When do I get something back, Labour? And it's just been a nightmare. Like, they've come in. What's happened? We had the riots, the Great Gammon Uprising of 2024. We had that. And Keir Starmer has decided he will beat the allegations of disproportionate two-tier policing by putting people in prison for social media posts. Wicked. Good job, mate. We have steadfastly refused to rescind the Tory policy on benefit caps for children. Now we've cut pensioners' fuel. Then we gave a massive pay rise to the train drivers to break their strike, which is fine. I got no problem with the strike action. I got no problem with the train drivers. Although I'll tell you, a lot of working people don't have that working class solidarity fucking feel, because their jobs were on the line because they couldn't get to work. It's just been so bad. And do you know what his message was? He gave a public speech. Keir Starmer. He got up. And he said, I hate to break it to you, but things are going to get worse before they get better. Mate, we were on our fucking knees. How can it get worse? Like, what happens next? Like, we were on our fucking knees in this country. Like, please. Like, I don't know. Like, anarchy would be better than this. This is ridiculous. But here we are. So, yeah, great. And I knew it was going to happen. Not to mention, oh, God, God help me, that I'm not going to walk back Brexit, but now I'm off into a room with France and Germany to talk about a special kind of treaty that will definitely help Britain. It's like, mate, the world is laughing at us after Brexit. We have to just keep a low profile, yeah. The whole point was, you know, let's be isolationist and fucking try and rebuild with fewer bricks. That was what we were going to have to do. Now we're just going back and the fucking Germans and the French are like, oh, back so soon, Britain, huh? I thought that Brexit mean a Brexit, huh? Fucking, all right, we were dickheads, okay? And then Macron's getting fucking impeached because he's a little fucking tyrant and always was, and a weirdo and a sicko. And by the way, the minute you see fucking America come over and campaign for you, that's bad. That's part of the problem. So anyway, it's good Thatcher's dead. I don't think we should exhume her body. I don't think politics matters in this country anymore. Next question. Oh, great. It's Reykjavik. How could evil... evil Keir Starmer not only beat beloved femboy Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, uwu, in a rigged general election, but now he besmirched the good image of the greatest Prime Minister of the country to ever exist, Margaret Thatcher, by taking down a painting of her from number 10. Does he know no shame? The idea... it's two. I'm leaning into it. I'm not letting that senile fuck Joe Biden take my idea away. I'm not doing it. You can spam it. Fuck it. It's there. It's a verbal tick. It's baked into my brain. It's going to kill me to fuck it. I'll pop. I reckon the reason I got sick, it's no coincidence. It's no coincidence that I had to sit here with a post-it note on my monitor like a cunt fucking fighting. Don't say the idea. Don't say the idea. Don't say the idea. And then I get fucking flu. I get flu. My first hemiplegic migraine in years. Diarrhea and sickness, and I'm just in bed, delirious, is you. You did that. You did that with your silly little spam. Haha, Richard Lewis is like Joe Biden. Joe Biden said it at the start of every sentence in a fucking 40-minute period, and he couldn't even end those sentences. I say the idea because it's a way to preface something intelligent. Joe Biden says the idea because his brain doesn't work properly. We are not the same. It's like, oh, everyone's on the Discord. Fat Ramir's there on the Discord. Richard's not streaming. You promise CK3 streams, you always break your promise. I was dying. I was dying because of the idea popping my brain. I'm dying now. All you care about is, oh, when he put a fat Finnish man in a video game again. I was dying. None of you checked. Anyway, the idea that a picture of Margaret Thatcher has any right to stay up at Downing Street because she is some sort of sacrosanct figure in British politics is inherently ridiculous. I think Keir Starmer did well not to piss on the painting after he took it down. But I will add, Keir Starmer's got no right. This is cheap points, Karen. This is what, this is pageantry, theatricality and deception. That's what's happening there. What Keir Starmer's doing there is he knows by taking it down, everyone's going to go, oh, he's one of us, one of us. He is not fucking one of us, lads. He's not. He's fucking not, is he? He's got more in common with fucking Margaret Thatcher than other fucking prime ministers we've had, frankly. But he knows if he takes it down, it's a statement, and the media will grab it, and all the Tories will go, well, it's very disrespectful, and all the fucking Labour will go, oh, yeah, fuck that, yeah. He's Thatcher with a dick. Like, what are we doing? He's fucking, his policies are going to fucking destroy the working class in this country. They're going to destroy the NHS. Yeah, and the Grenfell thing. Thank you, Jace. Surely, Labour, Party of Justice, Keir Starmer, comes from the CPS. When, how has no one been held accountable? I remember I saw that live on stream. You guys were there. Remember, somebody said, have you seen what's happening in this fucking tower? I said, what's happening? We put it on live, didn't we? And it was just a tower just burning insanely. With people inside, 73 people died. It's took all this time to arrive at a conclusion. They published this report today, which I was looking at before I went live on stream. But it's not good enough. There's people just, they're going to walk. It's like, on top of that, you know, what are we doing? This is like, it's kind of like another Hillsborough, you know. It's like, people died because of greed, negligence, and the fact no one gives a fuck about the working class in this country. That was it. Oh, what, do the proles live in that building? Just throw up that fucking cheap cladding, yeah? Oh, they're on, oh, bloody hell, it's on fire, and we knew it was fucking flammable, and we knew this was a risk, and now 73 people are dead. Well, don't worry, we didn't lose anyone important, just working class scum. I guess my windows don't get cleaned this weekend, right? That was the fucking attitude. Same with Hillsborough, it's just football fans, they're all animals, you know, years of fucking Thatcher putting that into people's brains. And so publish false stories about them to help, you know, take the pressure off the police who were responsible. Took all this fucking time. Just people that were culpable for that got to die of old age instead of dying in the fucking prison cells they should have been rotting in. And it's going the same way with Grenfell. Like, you gotta fucking lock some people up for that. Yeah, and the post office scandal. For those who don't know about that, postmasters, there was a calculation error in accounting software that was rolled out and mandatory by the post office. And people who were running post offices, postmasters, they were saying, reporting, like, where's this money at? And they're going, well, you've stolen it. You've committed an act of fraud. And they're going, I can assure you I haven't. They did an investigation. They locked those people up. And they knew. They put people in prison for years for fraud, and they knew their software was bunk, and they tried to cover it up. I don't think people look at Britain like it's some sort of like bastion of like, oh, you've got one of the greatest justice systems in the world. You've got like all that. You've got like socialist healthcare. You've got all this great stuff. Modern Britain is a fucking disgrace. We make some banana republics look good. We've had so just an erosion of civil liberties in this country that it would make you sick to your stomach if you wrote them all down. We have got a working class communities have never been more divided, and yet the working class are the most demonized by the fucking establishment people, and yet they've been sticking it up our ass for fucking decades. It's crazy. It is crazy. What is happening in Britain. And Keir Starmer represents a continuation of that. So he can take down a picture of Thatcher, but we've been living with Thatcher. We're still living with her shit now. We never fixed any of it. And he isn't a femboy. Exactly, Reykjavik. He's not even a femboy. We had a femboy prime minister. What a regression. But to get serious for a moment, it's been quite a serious stream, hasn't it? I guess, look, you spend 2 weeks in bed only getting up to fucking shit or puke and occasionally drink water. I guess you do get a bit, you know, into your own mind. I called this last year and I said far-right backlash is coming because when times get hard for the working class, that is the playground for fascism. That is where the far right operate. They love it. They love it when the working class are hungry because suddenly all of those arguments about how it's the immigrants' fault, about how if we only had a more totalitarian, authoritarian regime, and you would have some respect and status within it. That's when those arguments start sounding real fucking good. The far right comes round your house in the 90s when the economy is strong and they say, hey, do you want to come and, you know, smear dog shit on a immigrant's house? You go, no, why would I do that? Don't even dislike them. Look, I've got all this money, got my mortgage sorted. Staring at early retirement, me. Don't feel racist at all, actually. When you're fucking starving, hungry, and they knock on the door and they go, look, the immigrants are to blame for that, by the way. And you go, well, someone is. And I guess I can't overthrow my own government. So, next best thing, we'll just foment racist hatred against people that you've got more in common with. Mental. It just doesn't even make logistical sense. But these governments will not take the complaints and queries of working class people seriously. They won't listen. They won't move the football. They won't advance our shit. They keep telling you, you have to have less and less because we need to do more and more. Meanwhile, they get rich. Their mates get rich. The special interests that put them in power, they get rich. They get to expand. They get the bailouts. The banks get the bailouts. They get the pandemic money. You get nothing. You get less. And you get told less is your in your future, that it's going to get worse. And then somebody comes around and they go, listen, we fucking hate the political class. They're liberals. They're lefties. And they will always put the values and needs of immigrants over you. And you're a citizen and you're domestic. Let's fucking do it. Let's vote them out. Now, obviously, you're going to be under a fucking jackboot, same as everybody else, if you ever vote in a party. History shows us that. You know, it wasn't that Nazi-era Germany to use the go-to example for everyone on the internet. Those people weren't living in a utopia. Their own people were brutalised by the Nazi Party. So, you vote against your own interests, but it's a seductive lie, and it's happening all over Europe. East Germany, now, like, their actual far-right party, where, if memory serves me correctly, but don't quote me on this, but I'm pretty sure the leader of that party used a slogan from Nazi Germany, an actual Hitlerian slogan, in his campaign literature and said he didn't know. You're from East Germany. You definitely know, right? And people are voting for him and treating these people like they are serious options, and they are not fucking serious options. They are dangerous options, but it is going. But I called this in 2022, I called it in 2023, and it's going to keep happening because our mainstream political parties that supposedly represent working class interests and are supposedly, you know, going to make things better for us, they're not making things better for us. And so radical fringe politics is appealing in that environment. And it's happening everywhere. It's happening in Europe. It's happening in France. It's happening in Germany. It's happening in Austria. It's happening in Greece. Happening in Spain. Happening in Italy. And, you know, look, I can't blame people. I can't blame people for it. That's the worst part. You can't just be like a Guardian reader and say, oh, you know, it's your... No, people are fucking done, man. People are so done. As I said, speaking from a British perspective, we've had austerity measures. I think austerity measures were introduced in about 2010. So austerity measures, we had the global financial collapse. We came out of that. Our economy didn't bounce back quite as much as we happened. We had the LIBOR rate scandal where we found out bank executives were fixing LIBOR rates to fuck people over, to make more money for themselves. We didn't do anything. anything about that. A couple of people got fired. I think we even rolled back in Britain. I know they did in America, but I don't even. I think we might have rolled back the rules on banking bonuses. And all the while, with a straight face, the government comes to you and says, you've got to fucking tighten your belt. Sorry, you've got less. Sorry, your benefits have been cut. Sorry, you're getting fired. Sorry, this entire sector of industry you work in is being shut down for an environmental policy. And by the way, there are no other jobs in your region to go to. So sign on at the Dole in one of the most dehumanizing experiences you can ever fucking go through in this country. And let's just hope something comes up. Or what's that on the card? A total new area of work you're unqualified in, where you'll start at the bottom of the ladder for essentially a state-subsidized payment where it's below minimum wage. Enjoy. You're on the scrap heap at 40. Enjoy your life. And it's like, fuck me. No wonder people lose their fucking shit. No wonder people want to smash the system. Like, how many more examples are you going to need? If you don't have politics working for the people, people will try and change the politics. And trust me, it gets like, first we'll try the fascists, and then if they don't get in, because after 10, 15 years of fascism, you'll beg for a liberal government. And if they don't get in, you get the Arab Spring. Don't think all these other countries can be immune to that. That's why when the Arab Spring was happening, Western media not so interested in it. Bizarre. Entire governments being overthrown by people. They don't want you getting any fucking ideas. Yeah, and today, there's some riots in Egypt or something. Don't worry about that. It's bollocks. It's, you know, how can you not be politically fucking jaded when all of this is true? So fuck Keir Starmer. Fuck Labour. Fuck your face. With facts. I know, ridiculous. Right, let's end on a positive one. Tasty. Are you going to miss being spammed with pictures of Van Peter's knob by Brazilian esports fans now that Twitter is banned in Brazil? It's a sad day. I made a joke on Discord. I'll repeat it here. I'm just going to have to start dating Van Peter because I will miss the sight of his penis. I will. Won't feel the same logging onto the internet and not seeing Van Peter's knob. So I've sent Van Peter an email asking if he wants to go on a date. And hopefully, you know, fingers crossed, right? He's got a thing for overweight, balding men. Like some of the sickos in my DMs evidently do. So, yeah. God, it's been such a heavy stream. It wasn't meant to be. It was meant to be fun and light and breezy. And I still feel terrible. And my voice is giving out. I hate the reaction to the Twitter ban in Brazil. I hate it. It's exposed people as deeply hypocritical and stupid in a way that only American brain rot politics can. Why do I feel that way? Okay, let's start with what... Just objectively, this is what happened. A Brazilian judge wanted information taken from Twitter user accounts without their knowledge. Illegally, if you believe in... you know, kind of right to privacy and that kind of thing. And also to secretly suppress certain accounts that were saying things that were less than complimentary of the government. Twitter refused to comply. In retaliation for that, they have banned... Well, no, actually. So Twitter refused to comply. Then they asked for a point of contact so they could arrest them. Twitter removed their legal representative in Brazil, they took them out of the country. The judge demanded that they send somebody back there so they can be arrested and held accountable. Elon Musk refused. In retaliation for that, they banned Twitter in its entirety and have also introduced a fine of, it's been like $8,000 for anyone that would use a VPN to bypass to get on Twitter. And that's not all. They then, when Elon Musk publicly released information and said, I'm not complying, they banned Starlink accounts in Brazil because Elon Musk is the same owner, even though that's nothing to do with Twitter or any of the legal stuff. Now, that is... How could anyone be for any of that? But It's Musk, isn't it? And because Musk does concerning on fake right-wing news posts, people have thrown their fucking liberalism out the window. Ha ha! Yes, it's based to ban Elon Musk in Brazil. I hope he gets extradited. I hope he gets arrested. I hope he goes to prison. There was a fucking columnist in The Guardian, the liberal paper of record in Britain, in the fucking Guardian, a columnist wrote an article saying that governments of the world must threaten to extradite and arrest Elon Musk over the things he posts because he is fomenting right-wing hatred and circulating hate speech. It's like, this is like Trump derangement syndrome all over again. It is a special interest group, which is the Democrat Party and their acolytes in the media that do their bidding and publish state media that would make career in China blush. They lost Twitter the moment he bought it. They used to be able to back channel. They were spying on people with it. They could remove anything. People were getting banned for telling journalists to learn the code. If you made a joke about what fucking, you know, date the election would happen on or anything like this, or, you know, posted satire that was less than complimentary of Democrats, you got banned. Your account got banned. That's just all objective truth. Maybe you think that's reasonable. You know, maybe you don't. Maybe you don't care. But when they lost it, because Musk bought it, ever since then, there has been this authoritarian push to get it back by any means necessary. And so we've started. It's already, you know, been talked about where it's like they wanted a social media czar. They wanted like a government internet czar who herself was a peddler of disinformation. She was going to dictate what you could and couldn't say on Twitter. And they wanted to have this like almost like a branch of the intelligence community kind of operating within Twitter. When they lost that, now they've started threatening Musk. They say they're going to look into his financials. They're going to look into all of his financials. I've got some really fucking dark thoughts on this, which I don't know if it's brainwashed in and of itself, but I'm super worried about, you know, these fucking people in space that they've got to get back. And it was going to be Boeing, and then they said they couldn't do it. And so now it's going to be SpaceX. I don't know. I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it. That feels like a trap, sir, because let's say hypothetically that rocket fails to bring them back. I think that's a predicate to investigate, arrest, frame, whatever you want to call it, fit up Elon Musk. I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. I would not be facilitating anything to do with the American government whatsoever if I was him. That he's been explicitly threatened by it. And he's a dickhead. He is a dickhead. It's pathetic, actually, that one of the wealthiest men in the world, one of the most influential men in the world, posts fucking either... He's got two types of post, hasn't he? He's either got a shit meme, a shit joke, or just something that's objectively a lie from a right-wing account called, like, Invasion Europe or something. And they're the only two fucking posts he makes. It's sad he's not better. But to go after him in this way because he's not doing the bidding of a government, that feels fucked up. And people are saying that Brazil are in the right in this. There's no way. There's no conceivable argument. So, yeah, as the man himself would say, I think it is concerning what's going on in Brazil. And I hate the fact that so many fucking liberals that if, say, for instance, Donald Trump was doing this or Israel was doing this, they would go fucking psycho. They would go full Chris Akabusi. They would lose their minds over it. I want you to imagine a world where the Israeli government censors Twitter because Elon Musk wouldn't hand over details of Hamas operatives. And then banned his secondary business that was nothing to do... The fucking internet would melt. It would melt. And the same people that are going, pretty based, fuck Elon, fuck Twitter, Twitter's a Russian disinformation platform. All those people would be queuing up to talk about how Israel was fucking evil for doing that. So I just don't know. This is the problem with brain rot politics. This is the problem with it. It's the one rule. And the one rule is always when our side does it, it's okay. That's it. That's all you need to know. It's not difficult to negotiate. The world of the internet. What you do is you pick a side And whatever they do is good, and whatever the other side does is bad. That's it. That's all you have to do. It's all you have to do to be popular on the internet. It's all you have to do to get views, clicks, money, influence. That's it. That's all you have to do. But you must never waver or deviate. You must always dogmatically think. If you do not do that, if you don't stick to the dogma, well, let's just say your karma will run over your dogma, as the old joke goes. If you ever deviate, if you ever think about anything, like one thing, that it's where you stray from the orthodoxy, well, that's that. You will be destroyed. And you and the people doing the kicking, the people doing the brutalizing, it ain't the enemy. It's your old friends. It's your old buddies. That's how it works. That's the world that we built. That is the digital landscape condensed to its simplest essence. You're either in. But if you're in, you're in for life. You can never be out. And you've got to obey all of the rules, all of the time, and repeat over and over again how the rules are good. The rules are good and must never be changed. And the enemy never has a point. It's been going this way. I'm kind of trying to think when it really started to get going that way, culturally speaking. I think something happened post-Occupy Wall Street, I want to say, round about then, something strange started happening to discourse. It wasn't about... I think Occupy Wall Street shook so many special interests to the core. Yeah, maybe 9/11 too. Maybe. You're right. But I think Occupy Wall Street was different from my perspective, because what ended up happening after Occupy Wall Street was, instead of it being the very clear, like, we the people, you the special interests, all of a sudden, special interests and the people were all kind of aligned. It's kind of like the early birth of populism. We just didn't call it that then. It's like this weird cozying up where almost every institution got captured by American, you know, don't want to say intelligence assets, but extensions of the American government. The civil liberty erosion after 9/11, which I've talked about a lot, it was the single biggest loss of civil rights in America and civil liberties in America, you know, in my lifetime. What got written into law, having, you know, the NSA turned into a spying operation, the right of the president to be able to declare anyone a combatant in the war on terror and therefore rendition them, the legalizing and codifying of torture as an interrogation technique. It's shocking. It is shocking. But then the discourse around those things was still pure. You could still, you know, you could go into internet spaces and say things without it being called disinformation, misinformation, hate speech. You could still correctly identify, you know, who was fucking pushing back against your freedoms and civil liberties. Feels like you can't do that anymore now. You've got to pick a team, and you're on that team for life. Vote blue no matter who. I'd rather be dead. I'll always vote red. And it's really, it's just become so oppressive, and it's everywhere. And it breaks everyone's brains. It breaks everyone's brains. As I said, change the word Brazil to the word Israel, and everyone that is praising Brazil would flip their opinion 180, 100%, 100%. It's not even, there's no question in my mind about it. And that's how you know it's bullshit. Because something's either wrong, and it's wrong for everyone, or it isn't. You've got to pick. So, yeah, the situation in Brazil, I think Elon Musk is a shithouse. Like, he's so cringe. He's so unbearably cringe. His Twitter feed makes me physically ill. I hate the way that Twitter, for some reason, promotes his tweets. I have to see them every day. I wish somebody with that level of influence could be a betterment for society in the things he says. But the projects he's associated with, Tesla and SpaceX and Starlink, I don't know how much he has to do with them. I don't know how much, probably nothing to do with the tech, but they're his companies. They are a net good for society. They are taking us into a place And it shows the complexities where it's like the man has had his internet broken by brain rot politics. Even the wealthiest man in the world isn't immune. And so every time he opens its mouth, his mouth, it's hideous. Does that mean a fucking mental judge in Brazil should be banning access to a platform he owns from his people because Elon Musk refused to comply with what is ostensibly a fascist and freedom-impinging demand? No. I don't know how anybody could fucking agree with it. So, yeah, concerning. I'll probably do a bit on it. I'll do one of my videos. Because that is the last question we got there in the end.